Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
It is 7:23. I'm Howard Feldman. Good morning. And of course, it's Wednesday, so we're talking things science. Bianca Norgrady is our science communicator. Bianca, before we talk things scientific, let's do unscientific, which we're having this raging debate on the radio with our listeners this morning. Which decade of music is the best decade of music for you?
Well, most of the musicians that I listen to are dead, so I'm probably not the best person to answer that.
Actually, I tend to the
kind of classical, you know, they've been in the ground for a couple of centuries. So, but look, I mean, yeah,
I'm just interested. Do we always go back to our teenage years to a time when we were happiest, or not happiest, but we perceive ourselves as being young and carefree?
Yeah, I think so. It's funny because my kids are now teenagers, and so I'm finding they're listening to a lot of the bands that I remember when I was a young adult, and it's like those bands are cool again, and it makes me feel cool again, which I don't think I have the right to assert, but I'm claiming it anyway. And so, yeah, I reckon, I mean, that would have been for me the kind of 90s. I reckon the 90s and the early 2000s were probably the era that I associate with, you know, the most kind of young music, or what I think of young and cool, but
that's
then the rest of my
exactly.
music is most definitely
and that's
neither
the funniest
young nor
thing.
Cool.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure if I was ever either, but that's not the point either way. Let's talk about shopping addiction. Is it a real thing?
It is a real thing. And in fact, you might think that this is a recent problem, but in fact, this was first described in the late 1890s by a German psychiatrist. Who came up with this term, krankhafte Kauflust.
Ooh, that sounds actually very, very serious. That sounds almost terminal.
It does sound serious. It does, I know. Well, it was the pathological desire to buy. And it is, obviously back then that was before the internet and before the global marketplace. And I'm sure our psychiatrist, Emil, probably would have had no idea how big a problem this would become.
Yeah, have a field day today.
Mm. Oh, it's huge. I mean, some of the high numbers, so there was a study that was done in China that found nearly 30% of the population met the study criteria for compulsive buying.
Oh, my word.
There was another study done in 1,000 people in Switzerland that found that 3% of those were truly addicted to online shopping, and a further 11% were at risk because there were certain statements that they made that suggested they had that tendency. It's something that used to be thought of as affecting more women than men, but that's actually now changing, and that it's on the rise in men as well. So it's a global problem. It affects all ages, and it's not yet listed as a psychiatric disorder, but there is a push to actually make it so, because, for example, we have gambling. So gambling addiction is listed as a psychiatric disorder in the kind of the psychiatry Bible, as it's known, alongside drug addiction. And the issue is that it can be incredibly destructive. People really lose, you know, huge amounts of money from it, alienate themselves, relationships. And it is something where we really are in some ways powerless, because what's happening is that the marketing and the way that a lot of these online companies target people is they're really tapping into the reward centers in our brain. So this is actually, they're using neuroscience to make us feel good when we buy things, to make us crave that, to actually get addicted to this hit of dopamine that we get when we buy something, even if it's something we don't need or don't even necessarily want. It's that hit, that pleasure center that's getting tapped every single time we hit the buy button.
So is it the same route as a gambling addiction or another? Do all addictions share a commonality?
Yeah, they do. Most of them do. I mean, there might be some exceptions that I don't know of. But essentially, really what's happening here is it's engaging the dopaminergic system in the brain. So dopamine is a neurotransmitter. And there was actually a study that used imaging to look at the brain activity in real time of a group of people who were themselves seeking treatment for compulsive shopping and a group who weren't.
Right.
And they showed them pictures of images of shopping centres, of shopping bags, of, you know, desirable items like handbags or electronics. And in those that had this shopping habit, the reward system, the dopaminergic system in their brain really lit up. So it was giving them so much of that kind of that feel good that they wanted these things. And this is the same system that is involved in drug addiction. And what's also happening is that can kind of override our more rational control centers. So what we call the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of our brain that is more measured, logical and calm and rational and sort of, and it kind of overrides that. So it employs all of the same, it taps into the same parts of the brain that are responsible for many addictions.
So interesting. I'd love to hear from you on 061-895-1019. Do you recognize this in yourself? Do you recognize this in people around you? And what impact has it had? Before we end, I do want to ask you this question about ancient Egyptian mummies. What do they smell like?
Well, this is archaeological scientists really putting their bodies on the line, because there's been this long kind of history of conservators in museums noting that mummies, ancient mummies, actually smelled kind of nice. And so a bunch of researchers decided to investigate this. And so they used all of these chemical analyses, these sort of techniques, but then they also did sniff them. They actually used their own noses, which are a pretty good way of telling.
Right.
So the description was that they were woody, spicy, and sweet.
That sounds like something I look for in my cologne.
I know, or a nice port.
Yes, you know. Exactly, exactly.
A nice red wine, but obviously he's not a mummy. But it was very useful study, because they were actually analysing what were some of the chemical compounds that might be responsible for these at Romans. And they're looking at a whole range of mummies from different historical periods in ancient Egypt, and they were finding that there were actually distinct patterns of these kind of smells and chemical signatures from different eras of mummies. So it's potentially a way to, help to kind of tell which era a mummy might be from without having to do something more invasive like taking samples. So it's just, you know, adding more information to this
Absolutely.
Area.
Bianca Nograde, thank you. As always, it is 7:30. Bianca is our science communicator, and she joined us this morning.